So my Dvartara this week is in some ways a part two of last week. Last week, you'll recall, I spoke about Esav and who he was, why he was favored by Yitzchak, and I try to develop with you a more nuanced understanding of Esav, not a black and white one, but a more complex one. And this week, I'd like to look at Esav and his Shiduchim, or specifically, Esav and Leah. Because you all know the famous Agadita. We all know it partially because it's pretty famous. One of the reasons it's so famous is that Rashi follows it. And of course, when Rashi takes a Medrash or an Agadita, the Gemara, and incorporates it into his Parash Rashi, it becomes part of the heritage of all Jews. Chumash and Rashi, that's what we learned. That's what we learned to those of us who were fortunate enough to have an education in the yeshiva or day school early in our life, certainly learned it, and it's just a part of our discourse. So that famous Agadita, which Rashi quotes, it's Gemara Baba Basra, but it's also a Medrash as well. Torah says that Leah's eyes were rakos, were weak. And the question, of course, is, what was the problem? Could you not find a good optometrist? Like, what was the issue? And Gemara, Rashi famously say that she was cried, and that's why her eyes were so weak. And the reason she persistently cried is because word had it in the street that she was going to marry Esav. And when she inquired about Esav's qualities, she discovered that they were pretty miserable, seemed like an awful shidduch to her. And she so despaired that she cried and cried. And eventually, of course, the tefillos were answered and she was married to Yaakov rather than Esav. So the formulation of this of Rashi and this Agadita is that people in the streets said that she was bashert for Esav, but the Medrash Tanchuma uses a different verb, which I think is quite significant. And the verb the Medrash Tanchuma uses, and I'm going to really build on this to the best of my ability, is not just that people in the street were saying it, but they were ru'uyin for each other. They really belonged to each other. In other words, if you looked at things objectively, Esav and Leah made a great shidduch. They were ru'uyin. They were appropriate for one another. That's a much stronger claim. You know, street talk, people say all kinds of stuff in the street. Doesn't mean you have to listen to it. But the Medrash Tanchuma makes a stronger claim that they really were a good shidduch. They were bashert. But I'd like to ask two questions. Number one, what was there about Esav and Leah that made them so fitting to one another in the lashon of the Medrash Tanchuma? And even more importantly, I'd like to ask you the following question. If Esav and Leah were bashert for one another, if they were ruyin for one another, how could they have changed their destiny? If Reuven is supposed to marry Rachel, then Reuven is supposed to marry Rachel. That's their bashert. So if they're bashert, then how can anybody change their basherter, so to speak? And this is really, in some ways, a portal into a larger question of to what extent do we control our destiny? And if somebody, for example, entered into a marriage that was a bad one and the marriage ended in divorce, like what does that mean in terms of bashert? And can somebody change that? Wouldn't that do away with divorce? Saul asks, yeah. How do we understand this? I don't want to fully explore the concept of bashert, which is a different shiur, a different discussion. I've spoken about it in the past, different occasions. But what I want to talk about today is if somebody is roi for somebody else by some predestined plan, how can that change? But let me focus first on the first question, which is what was there about Leah and Esav that made them ruyim for one another? So the first and obvious part of the answer is that they were both firstborns. Well, two firstborns would be suitable for one another. And I think that that's pretty much the common understanding of this, but I don't think it's really a satisfactory one. I mean, okay, it's great that they were both the oldest in the family, but that doesn't necessarily make them a match. If I look around this room, I can see, I look around my Zoom room, I can probably see a number of people who are oldest in their families. It doesn't mean they should marry one another. So while that may be a part of the answer, I don't think it's all of the answer, or maybe even most of the answer. But I think that if we look at it a little more deeply, we might get closer to an answer, and that is, first of all, Esav was an Ish Sodeh, as I discussed with you last week, man of the fields. Fields are a place of considerable fertility. If you go out in the fields, the grass, the trees, animals, there's a lot of reproduction going on there. For the fertility of the earth, Ish Sodeh. And Leah was nothing if not a true earth mother, if I could use that term. She was a very fertile woman, and she had child after child after child after child with Yaakov. And in some ways, she was a kind of, in that sense, if you think of Esav as being Isada, the reproductive abilities of the field are in some ways matched with Leah, the earth mother, who herself was a very, very fertile person. There's the capacity to multiply, be fruitful and multiply, be fruitful and multiply, which I think at another level suggests a deeper commonality between Esav and Leah, that they were people who could populate the earth, populate the field, had that capacity. Moreover, if you think about Leah's children, think about Yehuda for a second. One way to characterize Yehuda might be as a Judaized Esav, if I can use that expression. Esav was powerful, a gibor, strong, charismatic, a hunter. Yehuda was powerful, strong, charismatic, a lion of the field. What is Yehuda? Is a lion. Aryeh is the symbol for Yehuda. And very much like Esav, of course, a Judaized Yaakov, influenced young person who claimed to be the father of David HaMelech and Mashiach, all derived from that line. But if you think about it, one could argue that Yehuda was reflected in Esav's gifts, but brought into a Yirah Shamayim Jewish context as a servant of Hashem. But those same powers of gevura, of power, of gibor, one could argue that Leah, for that reason, was really ra'oi to Esav. She produced a child who was in some ways like Esav, and for all these different reasons, you might say that she was truly ra'oi for Esav. Maybe you have other explanations too. But that's what occurs to me at this point. So that's why the Medrash can say that Esav and Leah were ru'uyin for one another. Which now brings me to my next question, which is, if they were ru'uyin for one another, then what happened? How can you change your destiny? How can you change your bashar? So from a technical point of view, what enabled Leah to marry not her Basherter, he who was Roy for her, but rather Yaakov, is through an act.
Okay.
I don't know what happened. I got cut off. Sorry about that. I don't know whether it must have been my internet or something. Anyway, I'm back. Can you hear me? Yes?
Yeah.
Nod your head.
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay. So what enabled Leah to divert from her Ra'oi to Yaakov was deception. As you all know the story, Yaakov wanted to marry Rachel. Laban wanted Leah to marry Yaakov. And so he snuck Leah in lieu of Rachel. And in lieu of Rachel, and because, as he said, we always marry the older one before the younger one. So tough luck on you. You got married to Leah. So Laban deceived Yaakov. But it wasn't only Laban who deceived Yaakov. He had partners to the deception. First of all, Leah. Leah was a party to the deception. Right? She agreed. She tricked Yaakov too. It wasn't just Laban. And another party to the deception was Rachel. Because Rachel could have objected, didn't object, and according to the famous Medrash, everybody knows, everybody's heard of it, I'm sure, that Rachel, according to Chazal, gave Leah the simonim, signs that Yaakov had given her, fearing, as he did, that Laban would deceive him, so he gave, they had certain codes to exchange with one another, and Rachel shared those with Leah so that Leah would not wake up in the morning embarrassed. So there was considerable deception involved, and Yaakov was the victim. I ask you the following question. Does that sound familiar? It should. Because if Yaakov was once the victim of deception, was he not once the victimizer of deception too? After all, his mother, Rivka, gave him the idea of imitating Esav and getting the brachas. And so now the Medrash, actually, the Bereishis Rabbah Medrash makes a very interesting point. As you might imagine, when Yaakov woke up in the morning in the light of day, he discovered that next to him in bed was not Rachel, but Leah. He was really upset. And here's what the Medrash says. Let me read it to you. Kol osa halayla, all that night, hayakore la Rachel. He would call her Rachel. He ono lo, and she answered him. Baboker, in the morning, he nehi leya, amar la ramayis bat ramay, you deceiver, the daughter of a deceiver. Kol halayla karasi lach Rachel. Be honestly, all night I called you Rachel, and you answer me? You're not Rachel, you're Leya. Amar lo, this is a devastating response. Amar lo, v'chigesh, Mora b'li tamidim? Are there teachers without students? V'chi lo kachaya kara lach avicha Esav? Did your father not say, are you Esav? V'yisa onalo, and you said, anochi, I am? It's a devastating repulse. Devastating response. And Yaakov, you might say, got his comeuppance. So, there are clearly considerable parallels here. Whereas I first try to explain why the Medrash Tanhuma would say they Esav and Leah were Reuyim and other, but now we see that there are a lot of parallels between Leah and Yaakov, which would make them a more suitable Shidduch rather than Leah and Esav. What are those parallels? I'm going to list six parallels between Leah and Yaakov, which suggest to me that while initially, at some level, Esav and Leah were the best shidduch, when you look at these parallels, you may say, no, maybe Yaakov and Leah are the best shidduch. So parallel number one is that both Leah and Yaakov were passive participants in a scheme, a manipulative scheme, which was contrived by a parent, right? Lavan is the one who comes up with the scheme for Leah, and Rivka is the one who comes up with this scheme for Yaakov. And as I think Joe pointed out in a chat, and this is of course correct, they were brothers and sisters. So this is no accident. Brother gets child to participate in a deceptive scheme. Sister gets child to participate in a deceptive scheme. So that's not insignificant. Second of all, both Leah and Yaakov were driven by a powerful yearning and will to accomplish their goals. Yaakov was driven by an enormous will and desire, yearning to achieve the bracha, Esau. And Leah was driven by a powerful desire and yearning to be the wife of Yaakov rather than Esau. Third, I think it's fair to say that both of them envisioned a future for their family, which would, as we now know, would be the future of Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people. And both wanted to play a pivotal role in achieving that future. Yaakov through the bracha, which is what the brachas were, and Leah through marrying Yaakov. That would not have been the case had she married Esau. Fourth, both willed contrary to what was appropriate, what was roi, what was predetermined. Both willed what was contrary to what was destined or predetermined. Leah willed to marry Yaakov, contrary to what was roi for her, which would have been Esav, as the Medrash says. And Yaakov willed to achieve the Bechora, firstbornhood, which was not roi for him because Esav was the first one. So both willed what was contrary to what was appropriate, what was roi. Both, not only, and then come to number five, both not only were passive participants, but they actively came to participate in that. It wasn't their idea. But eventually, they actively participated. Leah actively went into marry Yaakov. When Yaakov said, Rachel, she said, yes, here I am. And the same was true with Yaakov and Rivka. Rivka may have conceived the idea, but Yaakov sure wanted that bracha. He submitted to and became an active partner in that subterfuge. Finally, and I think this is truly interesting and critical, and really critical for my analysis as it develops, both assumed different identities in order to achieve their new destinies. Both assumed different identities to achieve a new destiny. Leah assumed the identity of Rachel to achieve her destiny, a new destiny, as an Am Yisrael, one of the great Imahos. And Yaakov assumed the identity of Esav in order to be achieve Bechorah and Bracha. So this subterfuge was carried out through an adoption of another identity. Therefore, given all these six factors, you might say, if you think about it, who was the more suitable mate for Yaakov? Was it Leah or was it Rachel? And given all these similarities between Yaakov and Leah, I think one can make a very good case that Leah was the true basherter, the true marriage partner to Yaakov over Rachel. Think about, although Yaakov fell head over heels for Rachel and loved her dearly, she was the Ahuva. But in terms of a marriage partner for eternity, Leah and Iago were very, very similar. Very, very similar. And consider where they were buried. Rachel was not buried in Maariv HaMachpelah. If you think of burial as being the ultimate resting place of a husband and a wife, then Yaakov and Leah were buried together. Yes, Rachel also deceived. That is true. Sharon says, I agree with that. But the point I'm making is that if you think about husband and wife in burial, it's Yaakov and Leah who are buried together. Rachel is al haderech. She's on the way. She's the outsider. So one could make a good case that Yaakov and Leah were really the ultimate shidduch, even though Yaakov favored Rachel over Leah. But the question becomes, and this is what I want to try to explore with you, how did that happen? If Leah and Esav were truly ru'uyin for one another, if they were truly suitable for one another, bashert for one another, how do they change the bashert? How did that happen? How can you do that? How could somebody who thinks that he is, Joe says, well, don't you need a contrast for shidduch to work? Yeah, you do. I didn't say they were identical. I mean, after all, Yaakov did fall for Rachel. But at some deep level, they were true partners. And I think, you know, the question that many of us have, like, who is my Basharter? What is my role in choosing my Basharter? Is there a Basharter? If somebody is unfortunately still single, what does that mean in terms of their Bashart? What does it mean in terms of their destiny? Are they destined to be single? How do they change that if that's the case? So I'd like to now reflect about how both Leah and Yaakov changed their basharters. So one way to think about this is to think about identity. If you are a certain kind of person, and that kind of person has a certain basharter, but if you change your identity, if you change who you are, then maybe you won't have the same destiny. That idea is really at the core of tshuva. How is it that tshuva works? Why is it that if it is decreed that somebody be punished because they did a certain crime, and then somebody does tshuva and they are not punished for that chet, how does that happen? Answer, they're not the same person. If they do tshuva, the person who did the chet before, in fact, was decreed to have been to be punished. But if the person does tshuva, he's changed himself or she's changed herself. And as a result of that change, they're a different person. They're a different person. They don't deserve the punishment that they were destined to get by virtue of their original. That's one way to think about it. And our destiny is contingent upon our identity. Who we are determines our destiny. If we change our identity, then we can change our destiny. And that makes a lot of sense, but what I'm going to do is share with you another perspective, that of the Sfas-Emes, because he raises some of these questions, and he doesn't quite put it in the way that I will put it, but these ideas are, I think, ultimately his ideas. So what is it that makes us who we are? What gives us our identity? What makes Moshe Sokol, or Mashi Mashi, or Bina Bina, or so on and so on? What makes us who we are? Well, many different kinds of questions. Answers to that question are born of certain parents. We have certain qualities, certain personality traits, character traits. A lot of different factors go into our identity. But what the Sfas-Emes says is that we can change ourself, our identity, by changing our mission, or changing what our goals in life are. What do we really want to achieve in life? So it could be that Moshe Sokol, by virtue of his personality traits, his character traits, whatever talents he has, what talents he doesn't have, is destined to accomplish certain things in the world. And that accomplishment is what the Svasenis calls a ha'ara, an illumination. It's what each of us takes upon, can do in the world based upon who we are. But, and here is the crucial rub that the Svasemes introduces. If I change my mission in life, if I change my goals in life, then I can change my identity. Who I am is not only a product of certain qualities innate to me, personality, talents, or whatever, but who I am is also a product of what I want to achieve in life. If I set certain new goals for myself, which I really wasn't thinking about before, they really weren't a part of my radar screen. But I say, no, I really want to do that. It's become important. Then by taking on that ha'ara, that mission, that new set of objectives, that transforms me. Who I am is a product of what I take upon myself to do with my life. So let's say, I'll give you an example from my own personal experience. I was always a very, very bookish young person. Used to read from morning until night, very, very cerebral and very, you know, very bookish. That's who I was. Maybe to some extent, that's still true. But then lo and behold, the Yavin, the Minyan, and the Flatbush fell into my lap way back when. Saul may remember, I think you were there at the very beginning and I was offered this position. It wasn't something I was actually looking for or planning on, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu has his mysterious ways, and lo and behold, I became the Rav of the Yavin, the Minyan, and the Flatbush. I'd gotten Smicha, but I was planning more of an academic career than going into Rabbanis, but this happened. And I found that becoming the Rav in the Yavin, the Minyan, and the Flatbush changed me. Not that I necessarily became less bookish, but that it opened up new vistas for me that never would have opened up had I not been the Rav. Certain concern for a community, gemilas chasadim, helping people, you know, those goals became more important to me as I became a Rav of a community and responsible for the community. And what happened was taking on that task changed me. And I actually became a much better person as a result of taking on the responsibilities of being a Rav in a shul. I became, I think it's fair to say of myself, a different person. Obviously, totally different. But taking on the task of being responsible for the well-being of each individual member of the shul broadened me, made me more sensitive, made me more empathetic just by virtue of trying to do what I felt I needed to do. I'm not saying I've achieved all those goals. I haven't. I always have ways to grow, but it did make it a change in my identity. And that's because I took on a certain set of responsibilities and those responsibilities broadened and altered and changed me. And I think many of us, if you reflect back about your life, will find that there's truth to that in different ways. Somebody takes a job, a simple job, whatever it is, but that job calls upon certain talents that you never even knew you had. They weren't really on your radar screen, but you had to use them. Let's say, you know, you never thought you'd be, very extremely organized. You were never particularly organized, but you got a job and you had to be very organized. So you became very organized in order to function well in the job. That's just one little example of many ways in which another, by the way, major change for all of us, is those of us who do get married, is marriage. You know, if you're living by yourself, you're living by yourself. If you're married and somebody is zochet to having a family, that's a big change in you. So taking on a new job or marriage or any of these things can really change who you are. We hope that those changes are good. The main point I want to make is that it's not only the case that identity generates your mission in life, which is the way it often works. Who you are plays a role in figuring out what you're going to do with your life, what your contribution you're going to make to the world, to the Jewish community. But this is the Svasemes' key insight. What you take upon yourself can change who you are. It's a two-way street. It's a two-way street. So what the Svasemes says is, when Yaakov said, Ani Esav Bechorecha, I am Esav, your son, and Chazal famously, Rashi says, Ani Esav, Ani Esav Bechorecha, I am I, and Esav is your son, which is a little deceptive. Tommy says, this is an example of Naaseh V'Nishma. That's right. You're right. Taking on a project changes who you are. That's pretty good. So when Yaakov said, Ani Esav Bechorecha, he became Esav. This is the Sfasemis' insight. This wasn't subterfuge. It wasn't deception in any obvious, in any gross sense. So Yaakov had the capacity to take on Esav's mission in the world. Yaakov ceased to be only Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim, that simple young man sitting in the tent. He sure left that. He participated in an act of historic deception, which is not consistent with Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. And that's because Yaakov took on some of the goals, the mission of Esav. Why, after all, did Yitzchak love and choose Esav? Because Yitzchak, as I explained last week, Yitzchak saw Esav as being the master of the world, grounded, rooted in Ishada, whereas Yitzchak was a purely spiritual being. They were a perfect pair. And Yaakov, in order to forge Klal Yisrael, took on the role that Esav had, that role of groundedness, of getting things done, not just a simple, naive boy in the tent, but making things happen, getting things done. And his whole life was like that. Look how he managed his prospects in the house of Lavan, how he eventually emerged a wealthy man by, as we see in this week's parsha, by manipulating through, a feat of animal husbandry, he figured out how to achieve great wealth. This is not an Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. And Yaakov recognized that if he were to be the Ava Uma, the father of Klal Yisrael, he couldn't be this naive little boy in a tent. And what he did was he took upon himself the task, the mission that Yitzchak saw in Esav. Yaakov, in acquiring the bracha, in acquiring the bechora, acquired Esav's mission as envisioned by Yitzchak, and therefore became Ani Esav Bechorecha. He became Esav. As I said, mission determines identity in the same way that identity can determine mission. If we take on a different mission, we achieve a different identity. Yaakov took on the mission of Esav, and he became Esav-esque. He became Esav. He wasn't boldly lying. To assume a different identity, in the case of Yaakov, was to assume the mantle of Esav's mission, and therefore to become a different man. He became Esav. And when Leah took on the role of Rachel, we don't know the dynamics and how this worked, but in some ways she took on Rachel's role. Not all of it, because Rachel remained Rachel, became the wife of Yaakov too. But maybe she took on some of the charm, the chain, the charisma of Rachel. We don't really know. We don't have enough information. We have more information about Yaakov and Esav than we have about Rachel and Leah in this regard. But I think for Leah to become Rachel is to say that Leah took on some of the mission, the task of Rachel, which I think was in part Rachel wanted to be Yaakov's wife who would sire the Shvatim. And that was her mission as the wife of Yaakov. That was what she wanted. And Leah took that on herself. That was the mission that Leah took upon herself. And in that way, Leah became Rachel. Leah became that aspect of Rachel's mission. And therefore, she became the optimal wife of Yaakov. That's because Yaakov became Esav. And that's because Leah became Rachel. And because each changed their identities by changing their mission and goals in life, therefore, Leah and Yaakov became a perfect shidduch. Because each took on dimensions of the other, which is to me a fascinating idea, which I think all of us should think about as we think about our Barsharet in marriage, for those of us who are not married or like to be married, or we're married and divorced, we think about this whole question of how do we change our destiny? What do we do about that? One answer is to change ourselves directly. First obvious answer. But the Svasemis is providing us with a whole new way of thinking about it. That is to take on new projects, to expand our horizons, to become more than who we now are by taking on more than we now have taken on. Could be growing in different areas. It could be in Talmud Torah. It could be in Gemilas Chassadim. It could be in Kiyum HaMitzvos. It could be in many, many different ways. There's so many ways that we can expand the horizons of what we can achieve in the world. There's so many ways we can do that. And then each person, I think we should always think about these things, kind of a shifting identities, going and growing and growing as much as we possibly can. I think the key point of this Svasemis is that if we do so, then we might be able to change what our destiny is.